The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 3, Continued. Chapter 36, Mr. Speaker. In the flood of endorsements from big names in Washington on behalf of Lyndon Johnson's senatorial bid, had one name been, for most of the campaign, conspicuously absent? Sam Rayburn's coldness in October 1940, when he had been reluctant to endorse Johnson for a post with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, had been thawed somewhat by Johnson's performance in that role. Rayburn knew how much he owed Johnson for helping to preserve the Democratic majority in the House, and thereby helping him keep the speakership. Rayburn was a man who always paid his debts. After the campaign, he was again courteous to Lyndon Johnson on Capitol Hill. But the thaw was only partial. The greatest favor Rayburn had bestowed on him, entree to the Board of Education, where crucial House decisions were made and strategy was discussed, was withdrawn. No longer, when Rayburn left the Speaker's chair in the late afternoon and headed for the room in which the House leaders met, did he invite Johnson to come on down. Had the Speaker guessed or learned how Lyndon Johnson had betrayed his friendship, how, to help his own career, the young man of whom he had been so fond had turned the President against him by falsely portraying him as the President's enemy? To an effusive letter from Johnson in November 1940, after the campaign had ended, there was no reply. A month later, Johnson arranged to be one of the speakers at an appreciation banquet held for Rayburn in Dallas, and played a high card to a man who so desperately wanted a son. Johnson said he had been a young boy accompanying his father to the state legislature when he had first met Sam Rayburn. Ever since, he said, he had regarded Mr. Sam as like a father to me. When, however, Congress reconvened in 1941, Johnson found the door to the Board of Education still closed to him, and it remained closed all that year. During this year, encountering House parliamentarian Louis Deschler late one afternoon on the landing of the staircase near the boardroom, he said, almost shouting, "I can get into the White House. Why can't I get into that room?" This was a rare outburst, however. It was not in Lyndon Johnson's interest for Capitol Hill to become aware that he was no longer on intimate terms with the Speaker, so few hints of the true state of affairs escaped his lips. As for Sam Rayburn, whose grim face had turned only harder now that he held at last the gavel, and the power and the responsibility that came with it, no one would have dared to ask him. It was generally assumed, therefore, that the relationship was intact. Johnson's staff hoped the Speaker would come to Texas and campaign for Johnson, and they were sure he would at least endorse him. And they were planning to make the endorsement a centerpiece of the campaign by emphasizing it, over and over, in a series of newspaper advertisements and in brochures. When they learned that Rayburn had, during the week of April 22nd, helped dissuade Wright Patman from making the race, they were sure he had done so on Johnson's behalf, and that the endorsement would follow shortly. It didn't, and approaches were therefore made to the Speaker. At first they were indirect. One was made, still in late April, through Representative Pogue of Waco, who told Johnson of Rayburn's response. He said that he did not feel he should make any kind of statement in the record, although he was writing all of those that he had an opportunity, telling them that he was definitely for you. Private letters were not sufficient. What was needed was a public endorsement, and it was needed early in the campaign. During the next weeks, Rayburn was pressed harder and harder, but no endorsement was forthcoming. On May 29th, Johnson telegraphed John Connolly, and one of the significant aspects of this telegram is that Johnson is asking someone else to call Rayburn, rather than doing it himself. "You or Senator," words, "call Rayburn today and ask him if he will release or permit you to release statement to the effect that he is going to vote for and support me for Senator. Tell him this ought to be done today in order to help us get organized in North Texas." No such statement was released. Johnson's puzzled aides began to wonder about the enthusiasm of even the private support that Rayburn was supposedly providing. Rayburn was a powerful force, not only in his own 7-county congressional district, but all across North Texas. The courthouse politicians in the little towns that dotted the prairies north of Dallas awaited only Mr. Sam's word to swing into action for Lyndon Johnson. The word did not come. By June, the puzzlement among Johnson's supporters was finding expression in letters. Warren Bellows wrote Connolly expressing concern about the situation in North Texas. Judge Loy in Grayson County is very powerful up there, he said, and is a personal friend of Sam Rayburn. I've been trying to get somebody to have Rayburn to phone Loy, but Loy has not yet heard from Rayburn, although I made this suggestion nearly a month ago. P.S. Can't you get Rayburn down to Texas for a speech? This would help more than anything else. Replying on June 3rd, Connolly had to confess that we tried to get Rayburn to call him, however, I don't think he ever did. We are trying to get Rayburn to come to Texas to make a speech, but I don't know what luck we are going to have. As Election Day neared, with still no word from Rayburn, puzzlement turned to anger. The arrogant Marsh, the only one of Johnson's supporters who would dare to express it to Rayburn himself, did so. In mid-June, he telegraphed the speaker. If you don't speak or send message by Saturday night at Denison, please do not speak at all, as I believe it will be politically harmful the last week. It will be interpreted as reluctant, tardy, and poor statement. Your position, whatever it is, already becoming unimportant because timing coming too slow to be effective. Sam Rayburn finally endorsed Lyndon Johnson on June 20th, 2 months after he had been asked to do so, and just a little more than a week before Election Day, too late for the endorsement to be of maximum use. Moreover, the speaker's public statement was accompanied by little private support. The definitive statement on the extent of Rayburn's backing of Johnson in the senatorial race was the result in Rayburn's own congressional district, in which 31,000 votes were cast. Johnson received only 7,000 of them. Following the race, Rayburn's troop reference in it became clearer. He had become acquainted with Gerald Mann, whose hometown in Sulphur Springs was not far from Bonham, and had liked the young man, a feeling that was reciprocated. "I was very fond of Sam Rayburn," Mann says. Although Johnson was already gearing up for another try at the Senate seat in 1942, Rayburn may have had another young man in mind for the post. On September 2, 1941, with Mann on his way to Washington, Rayburn tried to arrange for him to meet the president. The speaker told Pa Watson that he thought a short visit with the president would help all the way down the line. Had Rayburn wanted Mann all along, and endorsed Johnson only after he had become convinced that the underfinanced attorney general had no chance to defeat the hated O'Daniel? Johnson was able to fend off this threat for a while. Watson told Rayburn that he was sure there would be no difficulty arranging for an appointment with the Attorney General of Texas, but he was wrong about that. On September 11th, Watson was informed that Miss Tully says the President does not want to see Gerald Mann at this time. Mr. Mann ran against Lyndon Johnson for Senator, and Johnson is now in Virginia recovering from a tonsillectomy, and the President wants to see him first. When Rayburn insisted, an appointment was arranged for the next time Mann was in Washington, but the appointment was made for a Sunday, and the Sunday happened to be December 7th. Pearl Harbor restored, in an instant, the relationship between Sam Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson. During the senatorial campaign, Johnson had promised, "If the day ever comes when my vote must be cast to send your boy to the trenches, that day Lyndon Johnson will leave his Senate seat and go with him." So popular had that promise proven in hawkish Texas that the candidate repeated it in almost every major speech and in every form of campaign literature. Though his seat was still in the House, the promise could not be broken, not if he wanted to continue to have a political career in Texas. Johnson had some months previously been commissioned a lieutenant commander in the United States Naval Reserve, and on December 11th he was placed on active duty. Rising in the House, he said, "Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent for an indefinite leave of absence." "Is there objection to the request of the gentleman from Texas?" Rayburn asked. There being none, Rayburn said, "So be it." The story of the naval service of Lyndon Johnson was to prove a very complicated one. As his actions during the war and his own private statements to contemporaries were to demonstrate, it was a story motivated by considerations at least as much political as patriotic. But to Sam Rayburn, to whom some things were very simple, there was nothing complicated at all about a brave young man in uniform going off to fight for his country, perhaps to die. Rayburn was a profoundly silent man, determined that no one ever be able to guess his feelings. But as the coldness of a father toward an estranged son melts in a moment when the boy is in danger, so Rayburn's coldness to Lyndon Johnson melted now. Their exchanges of friendly letters had long since dried up. There had been none for more than a year, But Johnson wrote one on December 18th, a few days before he was to depart for the West Coast. He was worried about the speaker's health, he said. He hoped Rayburn would take care of himself. During the next few months, he said, "You must carry a burden that few, if any, men in our country can carry. You have never shirked a duty or failed a responsibility. You won't now, unless the old physical self cracks up. So take this suggestion from one much less experienced than yourself. Get fitted." The letter was signed, "Just one who respects you and loves you, LBJ. Sam Rayburn folded over that letter several times, until it was small enough to fit into his billfold. He carried it around in his billfold for a long time. Then he placed it in a special drawer in his desk, the drawer in which he kept the letters from his mother. When, 18 years later, officials of the Sam Rayburn Library itemized the contents of that drawer, the letter was still there. If to Sam Rayburn Lyndon Johnson was the brave young man going off to war, there was a brave young wife staying behind. The shy, timid young woman, when he had first met her almost as lonely in Washington as he was, to whom his heart had gone out in paternal fondness, and who had repaid him, and more than repaid him, by making him feel at home in the Johnsons' apartment. After his initial trip to the coast, Lyndon Johnson returned to Washington. In February he left again. This time it was reported for the South Pacific. He and John Connolly, also in Navy uniform, left from Union Station, and Lady Bird Johnson and Connolly's wife, Nellie, went down to the station to say goodbye. So did Sam Rayburn. He had abruptly announced that he was going down to the station with them. The giant terminal was, in Lady Bird's word, a hubbub, jammed with sailors, soldiers, and marines, their women kissing them goodbye. Amid the tumult, Rayburn stood alone, square and silent as he always stood, well behind the young couple of whom he was so fond. As the Johnsons said goodbye to each other, he said nothing. His face was as expressionless as ever. But after the train had pulled out, he came up to Lady Bird and Nellie. His words were not tender. Only if you knew Sam Rayburn would you know what was behind them. "Now, girls," Sam Rayburn said, with the gruffness of a man who could never be cheerful no matter how hard he tried, and who knew it, but who was determined to be as cheerful as he could. "Now, girls, we're going to get us the best dinner in Washington." In understanding what many perceptive men had so much difficulty in understanding, the bond that, for the next 20 years, made Sam Rayburn the ally of a man so utterly opposite to him in both principles and personality, part of the answer lies in Lady Bird Johnson's sweetness and graciousness, and in the shyness that made Rayburn so fond of her. While Lyndon was away during the war, the speaker hovered over Lady Bird, paternally protective, smoothing her work as she tried to run her husband's office in his absence, providing evenings out for her, and for the wives of other young men who were off to war, not only for Nellie Connolly, but for Elizabeth Rowe, Jim's wife, for example. Of all the proofs of the power of Lady Bird's graciousness, perhaps none is more convincing than the fact that she made Sam Rayburn feel at home in her home. For the rest of his life he would come to dinner as often as several times a week. The only stipulation he made was that blamed television set be turned off. She had his favorite recipes down pat, and with her unfailing warmth made him feel she was happy to prepare them. When the Johnsons acquired a cook, the cook was taught how to make cornbread and chili, the way Mr. Sam liked them. The bond between Lady Bird and Mr. Sam was to become strong. Talking of the speaker, she says with a fierceness very unusual for her, "He was the best of us, the best of simple American stock." In his times of sorrow, when a brother or sister died, her heart went out to him. On the occasion of one death, she wrote him, "We wish we could put our arms around you today. Your sadness is ours too." Rayburn was to write her, "Your friendship for me is one of the most heartening things in my life." During Lady Bird's pregnancies, the speaker's concern about her health was so deep as to amuse those who witnessed it. He was constantly asking Johnson to telephone her to find out if she was all right. Once, when Johnson did not immediately do so, he rasped, "Go call her this minute." Then came the children, Linda Bird in 1944 and Lucy Baines 3 years later. Sam Rayburn had wanted a child so badly, but he had had none and never would. He loved Lyndon's. He would sit for hours with one of the girls on his lap, patiently listening to her gabble. As soon as Linda Bird could talk, he taught her a sentence. "We are just two old pals." He gave them birthday parties at his apartment, inviting perhaps 10 or 12 of their friends. The children's parents stared as they watched the little girls or boys sitting on the speaker's lap or reaching up to hug him. This man whom other men only feared. One of these fathers, the lobbyist Dale Miller, says that he realized, watching Sam Rayburn, what he had never known, that he was a kind man, but he would be distressed if he ever thought you had found that out. Lyndon Johnson's family became Sam Rayburn's family, the family he had never had. Also cementing the bond between the two men was Johnson's talent as a professional son. He knew now how much he needed Mr. Sam. For the next 2 decades, Sam Rayburn held power in Washington. Presidents came and went, Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, but whoever was president, Sam Rayburn was speaker. He held the post he had dreamed of as a boy for almost 17 of the 21 years after 1940, more years than any other man in American history. Over his branch of government, his power was immense, so great that it spilled over into the government as a whole. Johnson needed him not only at the moment, when he was still only a junior member of the body the older man ruled. He needed him for the realization of his great ambition. And he knew it. "If you want to be president," he told William O. Douglas during the 1940s, "you've got to do it through Sam Rayburn." And, needing the speaker as his friend, Johnson devoted his energy and his skill to making him one. He reiterated his version of their first meeting. "My dear Mr. Speaker," he was to write in 1957, "when I was a very little boy in knee breeches and high-button shoes, my daddy told me that there's a young fellow from Bonham who's a mighty good friend, and don't you go forgetting it. I promised to remember, and that was the smartest promise I ever made in my life." Reiterated it so often that Rayburn eventually came to believe that he remembered it too. Nominating Johnson for the presidency in 1960, Rayburn said, "I'm going to present to you today a man that I've known since his babyhood." As Rayburn grew old, that story came to mean more and more to him. At one banquet, when Rayburn was 76, Senator Ralph Yarborough was to recall, "Lyndon was telling the story about how Sam had first seen him running up and down the aisles of the Texas House of Representatives in short pants. He was telling how he's been like a father to me." I saw tears come out of Rayburn's eyes at this banquet and roll down his cheeks. When Linda Bird was born in 1944, Johnson telephoned Rayburn with the news and made a point of telling him he was the first person he had called, even before he had telephoned his own mother. He entertained Rayburn's favorite sister, Lucinda, Miss Lou, on her annual visits to Washington, and when she was back in Bonham, wrote her to keep her up to date on the speaker's health, and sent her presents, including candy in boxes so elaborate that she kept them on her vanity table as decorations. And he did nothing to discourage the bond between Rayburn and Lady Bird. During the first decade of her marriage, Lady Bird was not usually present at dinners at which her husband discussed serious political business, unless the speaker was present. If he was, she would be brought along, even if she was the only wife there. During the war years, she recalls, sometimes a group of Texans would go out to dinner at the Occidental or to Hall's restaurant for blue points and lobster. This would be the speaker and perhaps Wright Patman and others. The other men would leave their wives home, because they would be talking business. There would be 3 or 4 or 5 men, and me. For some reason, Lyndon always took me. Although the relationship between Lyndon Johnson and Sam Rayburn was restored, it was to be subtly different than it had been before. Johnson's actions in the 1940 Garner-Roosevelt fight had lifted from Rayburn's eyes the curtain of uncritical affection through which he had hitherto regarded the younger man. If Sam Rayburn loved Lyndon Johnson, the love was no longer blind. Men who sat in the Board of Education during the next 20 years were aware of this, even if most Washingtonians were not. Says Richard Bolling, "A constant refrain was about his, Johnson's, arrogance and egotism. He, Rayburn, said to me several times the same words, 'I don't know anyone who is as vain or more selfish than Lyndon Johnson.'" He appears to have understood now what drove the younger man. Ramsey Clark says, in words echoed by other men who knew both, "He understood Johnson, I've heard him talk about Johnson and his ambition. I don't think it was blind love at all. But Clark also says, and Bolling agrees, and so do Ken Harding and D.B. Hardiman and other men who sat, afternoon after afternoon, in the Board of Education as the dramas of power were played out, that while the love may not have been blind, love it certainly was. Sam Rayburn could criticize Johnson, but he let no one else do so. Once, after Johnson's 1948 campaign for the Senate, a reporter from Texas was riding in the Speaker's limousine and remarked that Johnson had stolen the election. Rayburn had the chauffeur stop the car and ordered the reporter out of it. Says Hardiman, "It was a father-son relation with all that that implies. Johnson would just infuriate him, but he would defend Johnson against all comers. He loved him in the way he'd like to wear the bottom of his britches out." The most significant difference was that, although the relationship was restored, no longer did Rayburn give his love and support to Lyndon Johnson for nothing. He demanded from him, in political matters at least, the respect, even deference, that he received from other men. The door to the boardroom on the ground floor of the Capitol was open to Johnson again. But in that room, Rayburn ruled, and Johnson acknowledged that fact. Even in later years, when Johnson was the leader of one House of Congress, as Rayburn was of the other, he acknowledged that. The acknowledgment was in the names by which each referred to the other. "It was never Sam," says one man. "It was always Mr. Sam or Mr. Speaker and Lyndon," says another. "There was never a feeling that they were equals, never. Even after Johnson became majority leader, Johnson was quite deferential to him. He would argue with him, but always in such a way that you knew who was the boss. If there was a disagreement, Johnson would preface his argument by saying, 'Mr. Speaker, we're going to do whatever you want, but here's what I think.' If he did it that way," Brown and Root lobbyist Frank Altor says, "Rayburn would go along, but he wouldn't go along otherwise." Even Walter Jenkins, who idolized Johnson, says, "He kowtowed to Mr. Rayburn unbelievably. What Rayburn demanded, Johnson gave." Occasionally, Johnson's feelings, his true feelings about what he gave, became apparent, but he never let Rayburn see them. When he was in the Senate, he would sometimes say to Jim Rowe, "Oh, Rayburn's so goddamn difficult. I've got to go over there to the Board of Education and kiss his ass, and I don't want to do it." But he went over and did it, afternoon after afternoon, year after year. In 1957, when he was majority leader, he attended the dedication of the Sam Rayburn Library in Bonham. While he was talking with several prominent Texans, one of Rayburn's aides, House doorkeeper Fishbait Miller, came up and told him the Speaker would like to see him. He waved Miller aside twice, and when Miller persisted, exploded, "God damn it, I have to kiss his ass all the time in Washington. I don't have to do it in Texas, too, do I? I'm not coming." But then he ran after Miller to make sure that the message wasn't delivered, and hurried off to see the Speaker. And in return for giving Rayburn what Rayburn wanted, Johnson got what he wanted. For the 20 years after Pearl Harbor, Sam Rayburn was one of the rocks, one of the firmest rocks, on which Lyndon Johnson's career was built. In August 1961, Sam Rayburn, 79 years old, virtually blind but still Speaker of the House, was dying of cancer, so racked by pain that he was finally forced to curtly inform a shocked and silent House, while giving it no hint of the true nature of his illness, which he had long concealed, that although Congress was still in session, he was going to leave Washington and return to Texas for medical treatment. Vice President Lyndon Johnson was in Berlin, dispatched there by President Kennedy to reassure that city of American support. On August 17th, when Kennedy had telephoned Johnson to ask him to go to Berlin, he had reached him at Rayburn's apartment at the Anchorage, and Johnson had replied that he had been planning to go fishing with Rayburn that weekend. Rayburn had interrupted to tell him to go to Berlin. They could go fishing another weekend, he said. On August 21st, Johnson returned to Washington. Lady Bird at Andrews Air Force Base Airport to greet him suddenly looked around and, to her surprise, saw Sam Rayburn standing there behind her, as he had stood at Union Station so many years before. "Dear Mr. Speaker," Lady Bird wrote, "as I stood by that airplane in the gray, grisly morning waiting for Lyndon, I looked up and saw you, and my mind went back to so many times and so many trouble-fraught situations when you have stood by our side. You were dear to take the trouble to come out, and I want to drop you a line and tell you so. Next April is my 25th anniversary as a wife of a member of Congress. This quarter of a century of our lives has been marked most by knowing you. On August 30th, Sam Rayburn wrote back, stilted and formal even now. Dear Bird, he wrote, your note was very refreshing and highly appreciated by me. You know that no two people are closer to me in friendship and love than you and Lyndon. It has been a great heritage to have known you so intimately and well. Although the pain was very bad that day, the hand that wrote that letter did not shake. There was not a tremor in the name Sam Rayburn. The next morning, Sam Rayburn went home to Bonham to die. A friend who spent time with him during his last days explained why he did not stay in Washington, where he could have gotten better medical assistance. Rayburn, the friend wrote, thought that Washington was such a lonely city for a country boy to get sick in. Chapter 37, the last chapter. The Perfect Roosevelt Man. Pearl Harbor was to derail Lyndon Johnson's career. He had expected to run against Pappy O'Daniel again in just a year. The Democratic primary that would be held during the summer of 1942 for the full 6-year term in the same Senate seat. He hoped for Roosevelt's backing in 1942, and the president's negative response to Rayburn's request for an interview for Gerald Mann was not the only indication that this hope was to be granted. When, in October 1941, Wright Patman asked for an appointment to solicit the White House support to which he felt his record entitled him, Roosevelt wouldn't even see him. In 1942, moreover, Johnson would be starting not as an unknown candidate, but as one whose name had been made, through hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of advertising, almost a household word in Texas. The statewide Johnson for Senator campaign organization, established and perfected in 1941, was champing at the bit for 1942. He would have Brown and Root behind him again, which meant that he would again have all the money he needed. He was confident that he would win. But the outbreak of war, and his pledge to serve in it, made running in 1942 an impossibility. It would be 7 years before he got another chance. And when, in 1948, he got this chance, there would be a slight alteration in the platform on which he ran. In 1941, his platform had been all-out, 100% support of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal. In 1948, he no longer supported the principles and programs for which Roosevelt had stood. With a few exceptions, he opposed them. Even before Roosevelt's death, the change had begun, for even before Roosevelt's death, Johnson had decided that the power in Texas, the power that could enable him to move up to the second rung in his 3-rung ladder, lay not with the people of Texas, who loved the president, but with the state's small circle of rulers, who hated him. In February 1943, Johnson sent them a signal. One of their voices in Washington was House Un-American Activities Committee Chairman Martin Dies, to whom the New Deal was a communist conspiracy. An effort was underway in Congress to end the committee's existence. Johnson voted to continue it and to increase the funding for its work. Harold Young, a dedicated liberal, was astonished when he heard of this vote by the man he had so ardently supported, and telephoned Johnson, "You mean to tell me you voted for that son of a bitch to get more money?" Admitting that he had indeed done so, Johnson said, "I never claimed to be a liberal." "Well," said Young, "you sure fooled hell out of me." Then and there he coined a new nickname that he felt epitomized the cowardice before powerful forces of the man he had previously admired. Lying Down Lyndon. So long as Roosevelt was still alive, in power, the change was muted. The sentiments Johnson expressed in Texas, 1,600 miles from Washington, were not expressed in the capital, except to a small clique which revolved around Corcoran, now ousted by the president from the circles of official power, and already transformed, with remarkable speed, into a lobbyist growing rich on fees from some of the country's most reactionary businessmen, who hired Tommy the Cork to help them circumvent the laws he had written. By 1942, Charles Marsh was to say in dismay that both Corcoran and Johnson had reached the conclusion that the public is now tired of the New Deal, and they must be given something new. Corcoran arranged for Johnson to deliver in Portland, Oregon, a speech that, according to Marsh, kicks the New Deal into a cocked hat. At the last moment, Johnson edited out most of the anti-New Deal rhetoric, but a few paragraphs remained to give the tone. The speech was delivered, on December 8, 1942, at farewell ceremonies for the obsolete battleship Oregon, which was being scrapped to provide steel for the war effort. Johnson said there was another scrapping to be done as well, of a government that, he said, had grown too big. Many Depression-era government agencies, such as these old domestic museum pieces, the PWA, the FHA, and WPA, he said, have now outlived their usefulness, as have men who have become entrenched in power without making or keeping themselves fit for the exercise of that power. Men who love their country and would die for it, but not until their own dangerously outdated notions have caused others to die for it first. What about overstaffed, overstuffed government that worries along like a centipede? He demanded. While we work and fight to end the career of the paper hanger of Berlin, what are we doing about the careers of our artists in paper hanging who plaster us with forms and blanks and hem us in with red tape? The roles of candidates, human and otherwise, for our national wartime scrap heap is too long to be called here. Scrap them we must. End the entrenchment of the unfit we must. Break the hold of dead hands we must. We are wound and wound in little threads like a spider's web. In 1944, during the anti-Roosevelt revolt by the reactionary Texas regulars, Johnson sided with his state's New Dealers, but with Wirtz's help, he tried frantically to keep his role in the fight as minimal as possible, disguising it so successfully that after this battle the disgusted Bill Cottrell, another Texas liberal who had backed Johnson in the belief that Johnson was also a liberal, began telling friends, "Lyndon will be found on no barricades." Muted though it was during Roosevelt's life, however, the change had come very early, within a few months after the 1941 senatorial campaign, in fact. Even before he sent out public signals with his vote on the Dies Committee, he had, in a series of quiet meetings arranged by Roy Miller and Herman Brown and Alvin Wirtz and Ed Clark, let key figures in the Texas plutocracy know what Miller and Brown and Wirtz and Clark already knew. That, as Roy's son Dale puts it, he gave the impression of being much, much more liberal than he actually was. His manner personified the New Deal. He looked the part. He was young, dynamic, outgoing. But he gave a lot more impression of being with the New Deal than he actually was. Or, as George Brown says, he said he was for the niggers, he was for labor, he was for the little boys, but by God, you get right down to the nut-cutting, he was practical. Basically, George Brown says, Lyndon was more conservative, more practical than people understood. And by the mid-1940s, Brown says, in Texas at least, people, the people who mattered, did understand. You could see what side he was really on then. On the day of Roosevelt's death, Johnson's reporter friend William S. White wrote that he found the young congressman in a gloomy Capitol corridor, with tears in his eyes and a white cigarette holder, similar to Roosevelt's, clamped in a shaking jaw. He told White that when the news came, "I was just looking up at a cartoon on the wall, a cartoon showing the president with that cigarette holder and his jaw stuck out like it always was. He had his head cocked back, you know. And then I thought of all the little folks and what they had lost." He told White, "He was just like a daddy to me always. He always talked to me just that way." Then, White wrote, Johnson cried out, "God, God, how could he take it for us all?" But the king was dead. The day after Roosevelt's death, one of Johnson's secretaries, Dorothy Nichols, asked him, "He's gone. What do we have now?" "Honey," Johnson replied, "we've got Truman. There is going to be the damnedest scramble for power in this man's town for the next 2 weeks that anyone ever saw in their lives." With Roosevelt dead, Johnson went public with his change of allegiance. Because he had difficulty erasing the earlier pro-Roosevelt image that he had so painstakingly created, in 1947 he called in another friendly reporter, Tex Easley, to correct it. And after an exclusive interview with the congressman, Easley wrote that while people all over Texas formed an impression over the years that Lyndon Johnson personified the New Deal, it would be an error to tag Johnson now as a strong New Dealer. That may come as a surprise, but it is true. Except in certain, limited, specific areas of governmental action, Johnson mentioned three, development of water power, REA, farm-to-market roads, he wasn't a New Dealer, Johnson told Easley. "I think the term New Dealer is a misnomer," he said. "I believe in free enterprise, and I don't believe in the government doing anything that the people can do privately. Whenever it's possible, government should get out of business. As a liberal reporter was later to put it, just roads and rural electrification? This could have been Cotton Ed Smith talking, or Jim Eastland. It was certainly no liberal talking. On another later occasion, he sought to excuse his early support of the New Deal by saying, I was a young man of adventure with more guts than brains. If in public he was attacking only certain aspects of the New Deal, in private, at least in Texas, he was going much further. He was not a New Dealer, he said, never had been. He had supported Roosevelt, he said, only to get things for Texas. In private, in fact, he was now opposing the New Deal almost as enthusiastically as he had once supported it. During his 1948 senatorial campaign, he supported few, if any, of the programs that had evolved out of and were carrying forward the New Deal. He ran not as a New Dealer, but, to the extent possible because of his earlier statements, as an anti-New Dealer. And during the campaign, he attacked much of what was left of the New Deal. The shift in his views can be symbolized in a single issue, labor. In his first campaign for the Senate, he had told Texas labor unions, I come to you as a friend of labor. In his second, he came as an enemy, open and bitter. In 1948, it wasn't Pappy O'Daniel who attacked the big labor racketeers and racketeering communist union leaders who take orders only from Moscow. Those words were Johnson's words. Nor was the change limited to labor. Once he had said, over and over in speeches, in pamphlets, in posters, and on huge billboards, that he was 100% for Roosevelt and the New Deal. Now, he still said that he had supported a percentage of New Deal legislation, but the percentage he cited was not 100 or even 50. On 27 major pieces of New Deal legislation, he said, he had voted for the New Deal 13 times. The Dallas Chamber of Commerce, one of the most reactionary business groups in the United States, checked out his record and found it so satisfactorily conservative that it enthusiastically endorsed him. The change may have come as a shock to Harold Young and Bill Cottrell. It might have shocked Paul Watson, who had considered Lyndon Johnson the perfect Roosevelt man. But it would have come as no surprise to the young men who had lived in the Dodge Hotel with Lyndon Johnson, and who had said, Lyndon goes which way the wind blows. His relationship with the President and the New Deal demonstrated how well these young men had understood him. Before the paint had faded on the billboards proclaiming his loyalty to Franklin D., Lyndon B. had turned against him. A note on sources. Because Lyndon Johnson would have been only 67 years old when, in 1975, I began my research on his life, most of his contemporaries were still alive. This made it possible to find out what he was like while he was growing up from the best possible sources, those who grew up with him. And it also makes it possible to clear away in this book the misinformation that has surrounded the early life of Lyndon Johnson. The extent of this misinformation, the reason it exists, and the importance of clearing it away, so that the character of our 36th president will become clear, became evident to me while researching his years at college. The articles and biographies which have dealt with these years have in general portrayed Johnson as a popular, even charismatic campus figure. The oral histories of his classmates collected by the Lyndon Johnson Library portray him in the same light. In the early stages of my research, I had no reason to think there was anything more to the story. Indeed, when one of the first of his classmates whom I interviewed, Henry Kyle, told me a very different story, I believed that, because Kyle had been defeated by Johnson in a number of campus encounters, I was hearing only a prejudiced account by an embittered man, and did not even bother typing up my notes of the interview. Then, however, I began to interview other classmates. Finding them was not easy. For years, Johnson's College, Southwest Texas State Teachers College at San Marcos, had not had an actively functioning alumni association and had lost track of many of its former students, who seemed to be scattered on lonely farms and ranches all across Texas, and indeed the United States. When I found them, I was told the old anecdotes that had become part of the Lyndon Johnson myth. But over and over again, the man or woman I was interviewing would tell me that these anecdotes were not the whole story. When I asked for the rest of it, they wouldn't tell it. A man named Vernon Whiteside could have told me, they said, but they said they had heard that Whiteside was dead. One day, however, I phoned Horace Richards, a Johnson classmate who lived in Corpus Christi, to arrange to drive down from Austin to see him. Richards said that there was indeed a great deal more to the story of Lyndon Johnson at college than had been told, but that he wouldn't tell me unless Vernon Whiteside would, too. But Whiteside was dead, I said. Hell no, Richards said. He's not dead. He was here visiting me just last week. Whiteside, it turned out, had moved from his hometown and was traveling in a mobile home. He had been heading for Florida, where he was planning to buy a condominium, Richards said. But Richards didn't know which city in Florida Whiteside was heading for. All he knew was that the city was north of Miami and had beach in its name. I traced Mr. Whiteside to a mobile home court in Highland Beach, Florida. He had, in fact, arrived there only a few hours before I telephoned. Flew there to see him, and from him heard for the first time many of the character-revealing episodes of Lyndon Johnson's career at San Marcos, at which the other classmates had hinted. And when I returned to these classmates, they confirmed Whiteside's account. Richards himself added many details. And they now told additional stories, not at all like the ones they had told before. I managed to locate still other classmates who had never been interviewed. Milton Babe Kennedy, a key figure in many of these stories, was found in Denver. I interviewed him in a lounge at the airport there. And the portrait of Lyndon Johnson at San Marcos that finally emerged was very different from the one previously sketched. This experience was repeated again and again during the 7 years spent on this book. Of the hundreds of persons interviewed, scores had never been interviewed before, and the information these persons have provided, in some cases even though they were quite worried about providing it, has helped form a portrait of Lyndon Johnson substantially different from all previous portraits. This is true of virtually every stage and significant episode in his life. Lyndon Johnson was fond of talking about the young woman he courted in college, Carol Davis, now Carol Davis Smith. He told at length how, stung by criticism of his family from her father, who he said was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, he vowed, despite her tears and pleading, not to marry her. How he had gotten married to Lady Bird before Carol married. How, during his first campaign for Congress, he attacked Carol's father before taking pity on her agony as she listened to his speech. How, when he was hospitalized with appendicitis at the climax of his campaign, he awoke to find her standing in the doorway of his hospital room. How she had proven her love for him by telling him she had voted for him. His version of this thwarted romance, a version furnished with vivid details, has been retold repeatedly in biographies of Lyndon Johnson. But none of the authors who repeated it had interviewed Carol Davis. She was there to be interviewed. She still lives in San Marcos. Two of her sisters and several of her friends, and several of Lyndon Johnson's friends who observed the courtship, were there to be interviewed. When they are, the story emerges that, while indeed poignant and revealing, bears little resemblance to the one Johnson told. Apart from the central story told in this book, the following minor details in Lyndon Johnson's own account do not appear to have been correct: that her father was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, that it was Lyndon who decided not to get married, that she pleaded with him to marry her, that he got married first, that she visited him in the hospital, that she voted for him. Similarly, Lyndon Johnson gave a vivid and fascinating picture of his family and home life. This book is concluded on cassette number 9, side 1.